All right, I think I know most of you. Joe Hollander, Chair of the Defence Heritage Advisory Group. And it's my pleasure to welcome you here in co-hosting with the City Library for another one of our midday military history presentations. If you go back in history and have a look, we had this year is the 70th anniversary of the Malaya Emergency, and then 10 years later, we had Colfran Tazi. And so it's my pleasure to welcome Dave Hayward back to talk to us about some personal perspectives on Colfran Tazi in Borneo and Malaysia. There is a subtle difference, and I'm sure Dave's going to tell us all about that, aren't you, Dave?
Okay.
Well done. So please welcome Dave.
Right, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for coming to hear an old soldier reminisce. What I hope to do today is give you an idea of what it was like to live in an isolated jungle base in Borneo during Indonesia's confrontation with Malaya. But first, a little history to set the scene. The New Zealand government first sent armed forces to Southeast Asia in the 1950s to help Britain put down a communist uprising in Malaya known as the Emergency. Our Navy, Army and Air Force were all involved. After a prolonged struggle, the communists were defeated, and although a few stragglers still lurked around the Malay-Thai border, the emergency officially ended in August 1960. However, units from all three services remained in Southeast Asia long after that as part of the British Commonwealth Strategic Reserve. Now, I'm going to confine my remarks today to the Army only and look forward to a September presentation on our Navy involvement. In 1962, the 1st Battalion of the Royal New Zealand Infantry Regiment, 1RNZOR, at that time our nation's only regular force infantry battalion, were stationed in a brand new purpose-built camp at Terendak, or Terenda, however you wish to pronounce it. This is near the city of Malacca in Malaya as part of 28th Commonwealth Brigade. This magnificent camp, purpose-built, accommodated four infantry battalions, one British, one Australian, one Gurkha and one New Zealand, plus supporting arms and services. It included housing for families, a shopping centre, schools, beach clubs, swimming pools, sporting facilities. All of it contained about 10,000 people. This is a view of one small part of that camp, Wellington Lines, the home of 1RNZOR. In 1961, Malaya had proposed the formation of a wider Malaysia. West Malaysia would consist of Peninsular Malaya and Singapore, and East Malaysia, this is not cut up, but you saw on the other piece, there are three British colonies there, Sarawak, Brunei, and Sabah, or North Borneo. That was the proposal. The rest of Borneo, Kalimantan, belonged to Indonesia. Today, both Brunei and Singapore are independent of Malaysia, but at the time, that was the concept. With ambitions of their own, both Indonesia and the Philippines vehemently opposed this proposal. In December 1962, an Indonesian-supported revolution in Brunei was quickly put down by British forces. However, it provided the excuse that Ahmad Sukarno, the president of Indonesia, needed to commence confrontation in Indonesia. This was, to all intents and purposes, an undeclared war against the Federation of Malaysia. What did Indonesia hope to achieve by resorting to violence? To quote distinguished New Zealand historian Chris Pokley, the strategy behind the Indonesian operations paralleled the one that had been so effective against the Dutch in New Guinea. It was a combined political and military approach. At the political level, the Indonesians courted Afro-Asian support at the United Nations, where they accused Malaysia of being a neo-colonialist fabrication. What a wonderful phrase. Aimed at retaining British power in the region. At the military level, Indonesia did not want to provoke a war with Britain, but rather to maintain a level of operations sufficient to draw in large numbers of British and Malaysian forces for an indefinite period, with the aim of fracturing Malaysian morale and forcing Britain to question the validity of its defence commitment to the Federation. Pretty clever stuff, really. The first cross-border raid by Indonesian forces occurred on the 12th of April 1963. Initially, the incursions were small-scale, ill-planned raids by poorly trained irregulars. But after the Malayan Prime Minister, Tunku Abdul Rahman, announced that the Federation of Malaysia would come into being in September 1963, all pretense that the Indonesian army was not involved was dropped. Trained and well-armed regular soldiers began raiding into the proposed East Malaysia. With strong trade ties to Indonesia, the New Zealand government initially refused British requests to deploy 1RNZIR to Borneo. It did, however, agree to the battalion conducting security operations on the Malay-Thai border in order to release British and Malay units for service in Borneo. It's a very subtle difference there that I really struggle to see. In September 1964, the situation changed. Indonesian paratroops were dropped into West Malaysia and raiders crossed the narrow straits of Malacca in fishing boats. At this invasion of what was both an ally and a host nation, the New Zealand government released the battalion for operations on the Malay Peninsula. For the next few months, along with British, Australian, Gurkha and Malay units, 1RNZIR was busy rounding up isolated groups of invaders in the swamps and jungles of the state of Johor at the south end of the peninsula. Finally, the decision was made to go all the way, and from May to October 1965, the battalion commanded by Lieutenant Colonel Bob Gurr was on operations in Sarawak, in this area here. Their mission was to prevent Indonesian forces from crossing the 120 miles of border assigned to them. A considerable responsibility. 120 miles of border sounds a very huge piece of country to look after. It is, but of course the number of crossing points were restricted. Not the whole 120 miles could be used. Right, let's take a moment to look at 1960 Borneo. Lying astride the equator, it's a tropical land of coastal swamps, steep jungle-clad hills and large rivers. Mount Kinabalu in Sabah is 4,095 metres high. Mount Murid in Sarawak is 2,424 metres. And by way of comparison, Mount Cook is 3,724. So it's a pretty high country. With a land mass of 198,000 square kilometres, it's the world's third largest island. It has Malaya to its west, Indonesia to its south and east, and the Philippines to the north. Occupying roughly a quarter of the island, the proposed East Malaysian states of Sarawak, Brunei and Sabah, sprawled across its north coast, they have a combined population of about 1.4 million. This is the 1960s. Apart from Kuching, the capital of Sarawak, which you can see there, with a population of 150,000, there are few large towns. There are, however, many villages. Towns and villages have a mixed population of Malays, Chinese and Indians. While some do live in the towns and villages, the majority of the indigenous people, Ibans or Dayaks, live in small communities scattered throughout the jungle, usually close to rivers. There are very few roads. Outboard motor-driven canoes are a major form of transport on the many rivers. Or you walk on an extensive network of tracks. In general, the border between Indonesian Kalimantan and the proposed East Malaysia runs along a high watershed ridge. The Ibans on both sides of it have traded across it for centuries and, caring nothing for some politician's arbitrary drawing of lines on a map, continue to come and go across it as they always had, an added complication, if you like. The Gurr Battalion's 6 months tour can be described as successful. Through continuous aggressive patrolling from jungle base camps close to the border, they dominated not just the section of border they were responsible for, but some thousands of metres across it into Kalimantan. They had 17 contacts with Indonesian forces, killed or wounded at least 33, probably many more, and remarkably had only one man wounded. I call that successful. A year later, 1RNZIR, now commanded by Lieutenant Colonel Brian Poymanger, took over bases occupied by the Durham Light Infantry. As the Kiwis helicoptered in, the Brits flew out. The Poymanger Battalion spent May to October 1966 in much the same area as the Gurr Battalion. By this time, however, Indonesian forces seldom left their camps in Kalimantan. And although Poymanger's men patrolled as vigorously as Gurr's had, they did not contact the enemy. While both battalions were similarly deployed and employed, I will concentrate on the Pioneer one. That's the one I was with. 60 miles from Kuching, on the road to Semangang, the base camp at the village of Ballarin contained battalion headquarters, headquarters company, elements of support company, plus C company as the battalion's ready reaction force. It also contained the headquarters of 7 Commando Artillery Battery and one 105mm howitzer. It also contained an RAF Whirlwind helicopter complete with ground crew and the usual gaggle of trackers, contractors and odds and sods. Because of constant comings and goings, numbers varied, but Ballarin usually contained about 350 men. Forward bases closer to the border were named as follows. Plum and Mabu housed B Company, 281mm mortars and one 105mm howitzer, about 190 men. Nearby, a platoon of 50, made up from support company, occupied a small base at Panama. Gunungaja housed both A and B companies, two only 81mm mortars and two 105mm howitzers, about 300 men. Now, the photos that follow of Gunungaja, I apologise for quality, but please remember that they were taken 58 years ago on a pretty ordinary camera. The British 81mm mortar is a particularly effective weapon, still in use today. It lobs 10-pound bombs up and over hills, trees and walls, out to a range of 6,000 metres. As you can see by the almost vertical angle of the barrel, this one is aimed at a close-range target. Unless employed on a fire mission in support of patrols, the mortars were permanently loaded on base defensive fire tasks. In a previous appointment as the support weapons instructor in the School of Infantry, I had taught mortarmanship. While very well built and nice and tidy, the mortar pits were, in my opinion, much larger and therefore more vulnerable than they should have been. My unsolicited opinion was ignored. Quite right. The two 105mm howitzers would have contributed to the close defence of the base if necessary, but that was not their primary task. From within the security of the base, they provided artillery fire and support of infantry patrols. In a range of more than 10,000 metres, they had a long reach. Discretion being a better part of valour, I did not tell the gunners that I also thought their gun pits were too big. While an Indonesian assault on Gunungaja was most unlikely, mortaring it, even shelling it, was within their capability. As they didn't do so, my contention was not tested. Both Plum and Mapu and Gunungaja were designed to be defended by the base staff plus one infantry platoon. On rotation, the other platoons of the companies were out in the jungle patrolling and ambushing, dominating the battalion's area of responsibility. As I remember, the Gunungaja base staff, including headquarters personnel, signalers, gunners, watermen, medics, storemen, cooks, clerks and bottle washers, numbered about 45. Out of 35 strong platoon and a garrison of 80, feels about right. 2 points are worth making. In a break with convention, instead of being concentrated on one gun line, the guns of 7 Commando Battery were deployed in ones and twos in the bases. This dramatically increased the ground they could cover with fire, including ground well over the border in Kalimantan. Got a helicopter, have we?
Yeah.
Good. And even more radically, an RAF helicopter, a Western Whirlwind, was based with and employed by an infantry battalion. Astonishing inter-service cooperation. Unbelievable. I don't think it would happen today. Even with its rather small payload of 1,800 pounds, or 5 combat-loaded soldiers, the Whirlwinds were invaluable. This one is landing on the Ballarinan pad. Note the fact that it was capable of flying during the afternoon downpour, and the many drums of aviation fuel flying nearby. Aviation turbine fuel, AVTUR for short, is nothing more than high-grade kerosene, a useful commodity. We are inclined to criticise the Brits for being overly hidebound and convention-driven. Not this time. The Ballarinan base could be supplied by road, but the forward company bases closer to the border were totally reliant on aircraft. Everything needed to maintain the base and keep hundreds of soldiers fed, armed, equipped and operating came either by parachute or helicopter. Gunungate, the base I lived in. It was built on the end of a steep-sided ridge overlooking a small river. Here are some shots of what was a large, well-built and remarkably comfortable base. It did, however, require constant maintenance. Immediately, the thing that dominates is the corrugated iron. It rained most afternoons, which was the tropics, of course, thunderous tropical downpours, so keeping everything dry was a priority. Note the thousands of sandbags, the wooden walkways, and the firing slips and bunkers. Here's a shot from a different angle, and another angle again. The building closest to us is a long dropped retreat from the train, one of several. A five-seater, as I remember, good place for a catch-up with your neighbour. The base helicopter pad could take two whirlwinds. On a normal day, we could expect the battalion whirlwind to visit several times. Often it would deliver visitors in the morning, then come back for them in the afternoon. Other choppers might also arrive and depart. One of the tasks the in-camp platoon had was to man the pad during daylight hours. It would provide a marshal to guide the chopper in and out, and a work party to unload it and put back loads aboard. Accommodation bunkers were dug in under a roof of more, sometimes many more, than 2 foot of sandbags. But they were comfortable, as I said. Note the mattress and sheets even. This man's using a board to keep his boots off the sheet, so he doesn't have to undo them again. He's even got a battery-powered radio. While generators provided power for essential services like water pumps and battery charging, and a few lights in the command post, bunkers were lit with hurricane lanterns or candles. Fire risks, unfortunately. One of the storemen had a pet monkey. It was cute, but unfortunately not toilet trained. Under threat of death, it was banned from the store. But what I want to show you here is a rifle without a magazine. While weapons were always carried and not slung, they were not loaded in base. You can see the man washing his mess tin in that picture. He would have had a full magazine in his pocket, which is rifle. The base was surrounded by some rather fearsome defences. First up, thousands of sharpened bamboo stakes called punjis. Would you charge uphill into these? And miles of barbed wire. The two metal plates that you can see sticking up out of the wire. On the side we can't see, there's a flare. When ignited electrically from the guard post, the flare illuminates the area without blinding the post. Guard posts were manned 24/7. This one overlooks the one entrance to the base. As you can see, it's a massive affair, thousands of sandbags. In the foreground is a top ramp that I'll mention again. This is another accommodation bunker, and you can see the firing slits, as there were on others, and here's the top ramp. Unlike Plum and Mapu, that had no trees at all left, correct, Class? We were lucky enough to have some trees still standing and giving a bit of shade in this camp. This guard post gives a clue to others not so visible of defensive measures. You can see the machine gun and the radio. They're obvious, but the central also has a bank of switches to fire both illumination flares and explosive charges. At the time, the American Claymore mine was not readily available, but other devices, with explosives, nails, avatar, and imagination, some nasty devices were created. All flares and explosives were command detonated. We did not use booby traps. Animals can set them off, and you can't tell a friend, they can't tell a friend from foe. As I said, there was only one entrance to the base. First, a log across the stream, and the men on it give you some idea of the scale. Then a further 106 steps, I counted them, up a steep hill. Think of the work that went into all that. And this gate is one of two that are locked at night. There was a sizeable Iban village half a mile from the base. The villagers were employed to do much of the labouring work in the base. There were no shortage of volunteers happy to have paid employment. Each day about 20 men would be employed on maintenance jobs, filling and replacing sandbags, for example. They would arrive about 8 in the morning and depart about 4 in the afternoon. There was a countrywide curfew during the hours of darkness, and the villagers knew to stay within the village, not to approach the base. Here's Chiefy, one of our regular labour. perfect salute. We could have got him to teach it. About 5 foot tall and 7 stone, he claimed that he'd taken 3 of a dozen smoked heads hanging in his longhouse. He also told us they were Indonesians. I was dubious, but other workers assured us it was true. Who knows? Certainly there were several heads hanging in the longhouse. Dopey girls. Every morning, women from the village would collect the soldiers' dirty clothes and other laundry items from the queue store. You can see the clothing-filled baskets and the way these quite heavy loads were carried with a strap across the forehead. Is that clear? The girls would wash everything in the river and return them dry and neatly folded in the afternoon. You can see some items drying on the corrugated iron roof. Wonderful improvisation in the cookhouse. Like a giant blowtorch, a number one burner uses petrol under pressure to shoot a tongue of flame under these aluminium containers. That's the burner there, and the flame gets shot in through it. Pretty dangerous items, actually. I'm sure many of you have seen them operating. You have to be pretty careful. An oven and a boiler made from ammunition boxes, bricks, concrete, and after drums. And the Royal New Zealand Army Service Corps cooks produced magnificent meals under challenging circumstances. This is a meal queue in base men wore as little as possible to get some sun on the body. The alarm is a brass shell case, one of several throughout the base. Beaten with a stick, it could be heard for miles. On hearing it, every man would grab his weapon and equipment and report to a designated stand-to position. Practiced regularly, it was never required to respond to an attack on the base, but was used several times for fires and bunkers. A four-row shower block with concrete floor and drainage system. Like the latrines, privacy was not a concern. Here's a thought. What if some of the soldiers had been female? Let's not go there. This Heath Robinson device produced hot water for the showers. What luxury. The company quartermaster sergeant. He's responsible for resupply, and here he is in his kingdom, the Q store. Note the well-stocked shops. Every 5 days, platoon sergeants and the base sergeant major would submit their resupply requirements to the company quartermaster sergeant. He would consolidate the lists and send a pro forma base maintenance resupply demand to headquarters company in Ballarat. Amongst other things, the time between which an airdrop could be accepted were required. By routine, he stipulated 1,000 hours to 1,500 hours. This gave us time to secure the DZ before the drop and hopefully get 30 tonnes of goodies off it and into the base before nightfall after it. Headquarters company would combine the demands from the entire battalion and send them to the British Ordnance Corps specialists, who would obtain the supplies, pack them into one-ton loads, and deliver them to the Air Force. We routinely planned to receive an airdrop every 5 days, although weather could sometimes cause a delay. At some stage, we would be informed of the date and time of the drop. Here we have part of the drop zone security party moving through the village prior to a drop. It's also a good shot of an Ebane longhouse with its crowd of interested onlookers. I also want to point out the men have hats on, sleeves down, belt order, weapons not slung but carried in both hands. Even though we all knew the chance of contact with the enemy here was close to zero, we took no risks with security. Spaced apart and alert, these men were good, disciplined soldiers. At some time during the day, even occasionally at the forecast time, an aircraft would appear over the drop zone. We always hoped it would be an RNZAF Bristol freighter. They were much more accurate than the RAF Hastings. A signal would establish radio communications with the aircraft, and a drop would commence. One tonne of resupply on the way. The DZ was the village paddock, its field or park, an open grass-covered area about 200 yards long by 100 wide. The aircraft did not overfly the village, but flew at right angles to it across the DZ. This ensured that ogres, hunters, or candles did not hit the flimsy built dwellings at each end. A rather small drop zone meant that the aircraft dispatchers could only offload a few of these big cumbersome loads with each pass. As we normally got around 30 one-ton loads per drop, the plane had to make several passes. Inevitably, some loads would end up in the trees on either side of the DZ. Much hard work was necessary to recover these loads and carry them to the paddock. Hence the delight at the more accurate RNZAF Bristol freighters, less loads in the trees. Although there was no road to Greenham Gadget, we inherited a cut-down Land Rover and trailer. They would have been delivered to the DZ as an underslung load by one of these. The British Belvedere helicopter here is lifting a 105mm gun, but it could easily lift a quarter-ton Land Rover. The Rover and trailer were garaged outside the base at the foot of the ridge. Obviously, it could not have gone up the ladder. Here they are about to move a one-ton load of timber and steel pickets from the DZ to the base. This picture shows the buildings at one end of the village, the rather flimsy buildings. The high ground that has been outlined in the distance is the border ridge, about 3,000 or 4,000 metres away. As you can see, the DZ work party were permitted to dress somewhat less formally than the security of it. This shot shows the other end of the village, and the first building is the general store. The storekeeper and his family lived above the store. The local people had learnt to stay well clear during drops, but children were on the scene immediately after the last parachute. As I said, 30 or so one-ton loads per drop was the norm, and here the parachutes have been recovered, and they will go out as a backload on the helicopter. Not every parachute opens. Canned rations in a bad way. You can see the hands of a lot of helpful Eban kids there, and they would help us move the stuff back onto the paddock, and they were rewarded with the stuff we couldn't use. What they did with it, I have no idea. Enough to make a grown man weep, the bear ration candled again. The British Army Ordnance Corps resupply team did a great job. I don't remember ever getting a sorry can't supply answer, and we did ask for weird things at times. They also had a sense of humour and at least one talented artist. Tongue-in-cheek, we asked for a barmaid for the Sergeant's Mess. Gave her dimensions, 6 foot tall and 38, as I remember, and requested that she be scantily clad. Our request was more than met. Someone had a sense of humour for children, and a talented artist. You remember there was only one way into the base. How do you get 30 tonnes of resupply up there? The answer is you don't. On the ramp above the Land Rover, about a half tonne load is being attached to a trolley running on a steel wire cable. You can see another cable attached to the front of the Land Rover. This one runs up to a pulley above the top ramp that we saw earlier and back down to the load. When the load is ready, the vehicle is backed up, pulling the load cable to the top back. There it is unloaded and carried away either to the store or the cookhouse. If all went well, 60 or so trolley lifts would see 30 tonne of airdrop supplies into the base. Here's a load on the way up. That's the cable from the Land Rover. He's backing away out there somewhere. And here it is coming back down the road. Whoever set that up really made our job a hell of a lot easier.
Must have been good at 5 years there.
Probably a bit above them, probably engineers ago. I've no idea who built the base. I tried to find that out. We took over from the Durham Light Infantry, who were in it, but they hadn't built it. We're 1966 now, so that base had probably been there for 4 years. Now, who built it in the first place? I couldn't find. But it was very, very well done. Here's an empty trolley on the way down. Taken from the photo taken from the top ramp shows you the bottom ramp. But I particularly wanted to show you the barbed wire-laced obstacles, which have been set aside while the ram's being used and will be put back to block the way once the load had finished. Receiving an airdrop was very hard work for all hands, but most days from the time the last parachute landed, 3 hours would see it all done and dusted. However, on one occasion, after waiting all day, at 15:30 hours, I reckon we missed out on the drop and it would come tomorrow. I sent the work party back to base, told the security element to withdraw, and was at about 1600 hours, I was at the bottom ramp where I heard a plane fly over. The signaller told me it was calling, so I took the radio handset, told the plane it was far too late and to go away. Somewhat wanted to my surprise, it gave me a roger out and flew away. You're all green, you're right. The stocky stuff hit the fan. How dare some lowly ground job demand that the Air Force obey the rules? I have no idea what castigation my battalion commander, Lieutenant Colonel Brian Pomeroy, suffered, nor what my company commander, Major Brian Morstock, endured. But both those good men backed me. A time between was a time between. Did the Air Force not understand that? While they had my back, I was told in no uncertain terms that if I did it again, I'd be looking for a job in Civvy Street. And the Gunung Gadja airdrop was never laid again, I didn't have to. In case you thought it was all work and no play, in September, a couple of whirlwinds flew in a British concert party, ENSA, complete with instruments and sound system. Advised of their coming, we built a stage, complete with dressing room, on the badminton court. The show was very good. This is a comedian in one of several outrageous costumes, and he really was very clever. The George singer, and she was great. She really got into the act. The company 2IC, at that time Captain Mike Dudman, under attack. The crowd loved it. To sum up, 6 months I spent in Borneo as a quartermaster sergeant of a two-company base at Gunung Gadja was a busy and rewarding time, a highlight of my military career. While the entire battalion was disappointed in not getting the chance to test themselves against the Indonesians, as a base waller, I was not going to do that anyway. While the patrolling platoons would have had contact with the enemy, that enemy would have been well aware of the defences surrounding Gunung Gadja and were unlikely to be foolish enough to attack it. So the job the base team did would have remained unchanged. They also serve who only provide the beer ration. Thank you. Are there any questions?
It should bring some memories back to some individuals here. Well, questions. It's a few years ago. Yeah.
58. Where was Harvey Regan relative to some Hang Hang called Sri and Min now?
Yeah.
Before both of you two then.
I never got to Sabang then, but I understand it was roughly in the middle between. It was 60 k's out of Koo Chi. And as I understand it, it was about 50 or 60 k's to Samanga. Right, so it was in the middle.
Okay.
And then towards the border, and again, I can't remember exactly how far, with the other two bases. So we had a triangular setup.
You talked about the guy who won casualty with the Bear Battalion.
Yep.
It was actually, the name was Waffaloo, Johnny Howe. He was a part-time bandsman, but he goes to the rifle company and got the bullet in the forearm, came out above the elbow. He was in base camp for about 3-4 weeks, back with the boys. Pretty tough marathon.
It really was remarkable. You know, they had 17 contacts, a lot of stuff flying around, and they only ended up one man wounded. That's amazing. Really, mate.
Yeah.
I'm just curious, right at the beginning you said when Malaysia was being formed, the Philippines were upset. Why
Were they? Both Indonesia and the Philippines had visions of having Borneo to themselves.
Oh, yeah.
All right? A bit of empire building, if you like.
Yeah.
But the Philippines didn't get into any armed confrontations.
No.
And like Indonesia. But yeah, they both had designs of their own. According to Chris Pudgley, and he should know.
It was an interesting history, post-World War II, what was going on in Southeast Asia. Because, I mean, right up until early to mid-70s, there were still a lot of remnants of communist terrorists operating, certainly in Malaysia. You know, sort of a good 10 to 15 years after Singapore was established in 1965, and, you know, with Malaya becoming Malaysia in 1963. But there was still a lot of activity going on in and around Malaysia right up until around about 1980-82. So, yeah, it's an interesting history virtually from, you know, sort of 1948, post-World War II, right through to 1978.
The Indonesians that were parachute dropped into Peninsula Malaysia, and those that came across by fishing boat, had all been told that where to go, where the hotbeds of the communists still were. They'd been misled totally, because the people that they expected to have an uprising, you know, here we are guys, let's go, had wanted nothing to do with them. So they'd been given a bad steer. I mean, you wonder why did he drop a few parachutists in? They obviously weren't going to take the country over by force. They thought they would. So there were still hotbeds there, as you say.
Yeah, yeah. Any other questions?
What the locals wanted you there. The locals in where you were based.
Yep.
You had the locals on side.
Yes, yeah.
They didn't want the Indonesians coming across.
No, they certainly didn't. We did a lot of hearts and mind stuff in Poe's battalion because it was so quiet. He actually sent sections out to live in longhouses amongst the people, and the medics we had would treat all their ailments and, you know, do whatever we could. We helped to build some of their buildings or maintain them and that sort of thing. So there was a big program went into hearts and minds, and I'm sure it would have been the same with Gers, but just keep the people on side. We learned all that from Maya, from the emergency. Yeah, get the people on side. Yeah. And the employment they had too in that base, the Dobie girls and the labourers, they weren't getting paid. Without the base, they wouldn't be getting paid. They were pretty heavy.
Yeah, I flew home from Korea and landed in RBN. I was in a Qantas civilian plane, and they seemed to be some European locals, somebody in a cocktail over there. But the flight across that Sulawesi Sea is the worst I've ever been in the world. This lightning, thunder, the foot of the ground first.
What sort of aircraft was it, Tony? What sort of aircraft?
DC-6B.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so it wasn't the Bristol Primer.
No, it was Manila was the previous stop in Jabal.
Yeah. All right, good one. Cliff, have you got any comments, Cliff? Any comments?
Sorry?
Have you got any comments at all?
Well, quite often the things happen that we didn't know about until well after something, an event happened. And I think David would probably find that too, that there were things that happened and then all of a sudden, months later, we'd find a small thing come out and we'd find, oh yes, that person was hurt, and then later on in the second time I was in Malaya, in Borneo, we had people that were across in Indonesia on some patrols, and we were told we were not allowed to mention those until we were years later. I think it was
all hush-hush, wasn't it?
Yes. Not yet resolved.
All right. So no other questions at all or any other comments? I think we'll close it up because some of you I know have either got to go back to work or other commitments. So look, thanks Dave. Really appreciate it again. You know, useful
as part of our program that we're doing this year on anniversaries to commemorate sort of major contributions that New Zealand have given. And in fact, it's interesting because our next presentation next month is going to focus on another situation where Indonesia came across the border because it's the 25th anniversary of the team going into Timor-Leste. So thank you all for your attendance today, and once again, thanks very much, Dave.